Hi, welcome back to New Comedy Radio, Sabrina George talking to Simon Runner. We're now back in the house with Gracie still in attendance. She might join in at any point. I'll put this down here, actually. So Simon, you had these two characters, then you were touring around Britain. Where were you getting your... I mean, you had the original characters in place now, after your drunken night on the train. How did you get your material from them? Where did the...
I don't know. I used to drink a lot, smoke a lot of marijuana, take a bit of cocaine, stay up all night writing stuff, and then in the morning have a look back over it, and some of it would be all right. And then of that, some of it that was all right, some of it would work on stage, and those are the bits that sort of survived. I mean, overall, I've got about 3 or 4 hours of Alan Parker material. I saw it sometime a while back, I saw an old video of myself, I thought, God, there's so much stuff I'd completely forgotten. The whole routine about the poll tax, things about the Dutch and Dutch being Germans, really, what are windmills but swastikas put to a practical use. You know, these jokes I had forgotten about, really. But anyway, so yes, that's why where the ideas come from, I don't know. Can't remember.
Did you start off with the character and think, all right, I'm going to write for that character, or did everything that came to mind think that'll fit in with the character?
Yeah, that's the things that come to mind would either fit really sort of sent to the league against Tedium or Alan Parker. I think that's mainly... So occasionally I write something completely not fitting in with either of them.
I was going to say, what happened to that?
I don't know. I've got loads of notebooks full of stuff, you know, which I've never used. Lots of beginnings of things, like beginnings of a novel or beginning of a play. I used to try to write a play about a bloke who wanted to be Irish. It's called R. Dublin. It's a monologue by a bloke who'd never been to Dublin. Who just imagined he had.
Yeah.
Meeting Beckett and Joyce in a bar. Lost it. Don't remember what happened to it. Short film, made a few little things. Coat off.
So were you religiously sort of writing... Not religiously. Were you sort of quite fairly consistent writing most evenings? Or was you just think...
I can't remember. I don't know. Well, how did it, or how I do it now, even. Now I do much less time, what with the little ones. But every so often, what was a stream has turned into a trickle. I've got a new joke. Do you want to hear my new joke?
Yes, go on.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's a joke exactly, it's a nicely worded thing. Hello, you've put your dressing gown on your head like a hat. Yes. You say hat? Can you say hat? I can say hat, I'm very good at it. Hat! Anyway, that wasn't my new joke. That's
Gracie's new joke.
The difference between Jesus and the church. Jesus said, give your money to the poor and follow me. The church says to the poor, give your money to me and follow Jesus. It's as succinct as it gets. I've been mulling that over for years, I think. Someone said to me, I'd said something like that before, but
it hadn't come
crystallised into just the right words. I like concision and the minimum use of words, the maximum effect, that sort of thing. A nicely written sentence. And I've written a few nicely written sentences. 20 years, 3 or 4 nicely written sentences. It's been worth it.
Because you put in some...
I'm sitting here, I'm not moving.
I wouldn't say a lot, but there's a reference there to philosophy. Do you still read a lot of philosophy, or is that still left over from this one book that you did at university?
Well, I did read some philosophy. I read some bit of Schopenhauer, quite a lot of Kierkegaard, and quite a lot of Nietzsche. But it wasn't the book I read was Philosophy of Science. That was from a course.
Yeah.
I haven't read any more philosophy of science.
Lola.
Lola. No, we've already seen Lola today, haven't we? Charlie and Lola. But we don't think we'll watch it again. No. What about playing with a toy? No. What you want? We're doing some talking now. So, what about playing some harmonica? Yeah. Okay, I'll get a harmonica.
There you go.
So yes, I have read some books, but I got out of the habit. Books. Don't read so many books anymore. Every find one I love, and I'll read the whole thing. Really, that's how I live.
And if anything comes from that, you'll put that into the material. Because one of the...
Makes you think of something, yeah.
Yeah, because one of the things that the critiques which you and Stuart Lee share is that the reviewers often say you're a comics comic.
Ah, yes. Oh, do they? Right. I officially, in the early 90s or something, was it the Guardian did a survey of comedians, and I was the comedian's comedian, which made Malcolm Hardy the comedian's comedian. And I wrote a poem about him.
What do you feel about reviews like that? Or being
nice.
Given that sort of title?
Comedians, I don't know. It's alright. No point moaning about it. The one that sort of hung around. Certain lines follow you around. That you get good reviews and they're put into a big file and then they're sent off to various venues. But some of them, some little phrases follow you around. And the one that follows me around is... the most important comedian of the moment, or of the present time, the most important comedian, not funniest, which would be nice, funny comedian, important, as if an important comedian could be important in some way. Don't really understand that. But yes,
you don't understand that?
No, I don't think so.
I was going to say, how would you... Is it sort of, how like, if you said that in 1485 and in 2007, you were still having that following you around, that moment is quite expensive, really.
What is it? What? Not the chair? Yes. So, no, it's been, I think it's 98 or 99. But anyway, I turn up at a gig and I've got that written underneath my name. Most important comedian of the present time. Something like that, of the moment, of the year. No, it's not this year. There's someone else, and there's another important comedian. This year, I got, as reviews go, this last Edinburgh, I got, I was flattered immediately, but then started thinking about it. My show was described as the closest comedy gets to modern art. And I thought, oh, that's nice. And I thought, what does that mean? That means comedy can never be modern art. And my show's banging its head against the barrier. So obviously a long way from funny comedy, right on the edge of almost not comedy, but not art, and can never be art. But even if it's sort of still, you have that feeling of hope, don't you? Closest comedy gets to art. Oh, just some little, if I dropped a few jokes, maybe I could make the leap, and I'd be art. My show would be art. But then you have to think, what category of art would it be? And it'd be the category of shit art. Art that is perilously near being comedy. You can't win or lose. So that's all right.
And where did the doing the show with the buckets come from?
The bucket came from... Well, I started doing buckets. First thing I did with bucket was Andrew Bailey's idea. I was learning to play harmonica. Get the harmonica. Pass it over. Give me the harmonica. Over there. Don't bring it over. Fetch! I'm going to write a book called How to Raise Children and Dogs. Because there's a lot of crossover. Fetch!
That's a parallel.
Not useful, you know. You're very welcome.
I have a feeling we'd have 20 minutes of recording of Fetch.
And I started playing harmonica. I don't know what I did. Ronnie Golden or Andrew Bailey. Ronnie Golden gave me my first harmonica, but Andrew Bailey encouraged me a bit. And Andrew Bailey said, in order to practice it, just enjoy it and get yourself in a space where you can hear what you're doing very well. So don't play outside because you won't hear it very well. Best thing, put a bucket on your head. So I did. We were doing a show together, so both of us were walking down the street with buckets on our heads playing harmonica. It was great fun, I imagine. And then I thought, oh, there's something in this, something about the absenting yourself from the world slightly. And I sort of came up with some jokes to do with it in a sort of character. And over about 3 years, turned it into a play. I know you want Charlie and Lola, but we're not going to watch Charlie and Lola. No Charlie and Lola. What do you say? What about playing some blocks? That's always good, isn't it?
We could have Charlie and Lola in the background.
Really?
Yeah, why not?
All right, Charlie and Lola it is. Why? Yes.
She wins.
You win again. You knew you would. Can you say Charlie?
Charlie.
Can you say Lola?
Lola.
Okay then, all right. I carried unanimously. What happened to the controller? But where's the controller? Where's the controller on? Yeah, but that's what happened. Do you know where it is?
Bonnie.
Hmm? Bonnie? Orange! Did you say orange? You'd like another orange? Orange.
I can't see the controller anywhere.
I can't see the controller anywhere.
What does it look like? Grey, black?
Grey. Maybe it would be good for us to play. There's your room.
There it is.
We found the controller.
So you've had an introduction. It's Charlie and Lola in the background there.
That's probably illegal. I like the music.
So what was the premise of the play then with the bucket?
It was set in the future where a cult of bucket wearing had taken off. I imagine something like Christianity had spread as a sort of reaction to the modern world of... one of the characters, there's three or maybe four, but originally there were lots of them, different bucket wearing people in cells being interrogated. That's the idea. They thought to be some danger, and then we have a security lecture at the end who describes what just the very fact of wearing a bucket poses a threat to a capitalist economic system, because bucket wearers whilst wearing their buckets are at best indifferent to advertising. And with their buckets removed, are too elated to shop. So that's quite a nice thought. So that, and one of the characters explains why, how he came to wear a bucket was, they all got different reasons why they came to wear a bucket, but it's just a sort of something that might take off, the idea. A rejection of the world. Because a rock star, and it's a true story, a rock star got done for downloading images of kiddie porn a few years ago. Let's not name him, but anyway, he was done to make an example of him. But the argument being that by downloading these images, he'd help. He was morally responsible for the creation of the images because he'd created a market for those images. Okay, whether he paid with a credit card or whatever, the fact is by downloading an image, the idea that by downloading an image, you're morally responsible for its creation because you've created a market for it. You are responsible, in a way, for what you see. And this bloke realised that if it applied there, it applied generally, that by watching the news, in a way, you caused the war. Whatever you're watching, that connection between viewer, and so there's a sort of decision to not just what you watch on television, but what you see anyway, just to absent yourself and not take responsibility for it and wear a bucket. That was your idea. It doesn't have to be a bucket, of course. Could be anything. Lampshade, watering can. I would make, just do it. Make some films of different people in buckets. Different things covering their heads. Maybe some sort of secret organisation, people meeting up. We've got lots of little fragments of things that could turn into a film at some point, but I'm not in a rush, unfortunately.
Oh, and did that play, I don't want to use the word success, did the audience, I suppose, get it? Did it work?
On Good Nights, yeah. I did a run at the Soho Theatre, and it built up and sold out the last two nights, and I sold every copy of the script. I printed out a copy of the script, and it went like hotcakes, and I was very pleased. And then sort of didn't do it very much after that. It was often sort of, I honed it till it was perfect, then stopped doing it.
There's a lot. Why?
Well, I was a bit fed up doing it. You want to do something else? I'd stopped changing it. It was just sort of fixed. It wasn't, I say, perfect. It was as good as I could get it. So let it lie fallow for a bit and then come back to it. Maybe I'll do something else with it.
Do you get bored quite quickly with stuff once you've got to a certain point?
I think you get bored with it when you're not changing it at all.
Yeah.
You're just trotting out your acts, doing the same thing. And it's often when you stop doing it. If you're doing a run or something, I always find when you finish, lots of ideas flood in your head because your head's been emptied for so long. At the end of Edinburgh, I always have to stop. I think of next year's show, loads of ideas. Hardly any of which come to anything. But it's quite a sort of fruitful period. During Edinburgh, I start thinking about next year's show. Or something I'd like to do, or a place I'd like to do. Do something on Arthur's Seat. I've always thought Arthur's Seat at Dawn. Top of Arthur's Seat at Dawn, do something there. But then actually I look up that mountain and think, God, no, no, I'll never climb it again.
Not just before dawn, anyway.
You have to climb it just before dawn. But then, what's his name? Andrew Maxwell did that. He burned a wicker man up there this year. So someone's doing it. Someone else looked at that mountain and thought, that's where I'm doing my show.
Something's got to happen.
But I always thought if you could put on a show in a venue, find a venue, say, and put on a show at dawn, roughly around that time, and and it's a different show every night. Once people have come once, they're yours. They're a captive. There's no one, nothing else going on at that time. If you can get the dawn crowd, then they'll be asleep all day. They'll be up all night. They'll come back.
Ready for the next bit.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it'll feel very exciting, though.
No, didn't Ken Campbell, in his 24-hour show, he wrote some very interesting stuff about the dawn audience that would arrive before work.
Did he get that happen?
Yeah, he did. I can't remember what it was called, but it sort of ran
for space.
Well, I think that was loosely the theme of it. I don't know whether that's what it was called, but I think he ran it for 7 days without a break.
Mm.
And both the performers and the audience, it was something like that, yeah. And I think everything to do with science fiction and anything else, even Bailey related, got brought into it. But the stuff he was writing about the dawn audience, that they actually became quite addicted to popping in before work, and they'd get up earlier and earlier and earlier to see that particular thing, and what a different type of audience it was.
Well, in the old days, the previous century, they used to have coffee houses. Coffee people would meet in coffee houses before going to work to talk about and read newspapers and talk to each other. As a social gathering. Well, it's happened before. It could happen again.
It'll be exciting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, coffee.
Starbucks, no. Starbucks and the tabloids.
No, it's not quite the same.
No, it doesn't have the same flavour. No, it's sort of Lloyd's List came from... The newspapers came from Lloyd's List, which was the first one that did that. But and what about Sherlock Holmes?
Again, another thing. I've got 3 chapters now, roughly, of a book. If I keep going at this rate, another 5 years I'll have a novel.
And where did that come from?
Well, the idea of it,
yeah.
I had one joke, which was The True Confessions of Sherlock Holmes. The first 2 cases were a fluke, but after that I coasted on my laurel. And then, from Malcolm Hardy's book, Sit Down Comedy, they said, write anything you want. Right? So I wrote up my Edinburgh show from that year with the script of it, with how it went, different notes and how to do different things, and try this in a funny voice. I have failed. This has never worked, but give it a go. It's quite funny, an interesting sort of, you know, document, you know, for some jokes in it and comments about a show. And having said, do whatever you want, they then said no, but not that. I said, you do something else. So I thought, I'll extend my Sherlock Holmes one-liner into... I think it took a while and I wrote that.
Because that was almost a play as well, a monologue.
The first one was a 45-minute monologue. And then I was going to Edinburgh that year and I thought, well, I read it out at the end of a gig, sort of encore. Well, as an encore, the audience came back. They came back, it was their encore, the audience got the encore. And we're sadly disappointed. No, and it went very well. I thought, that's a show. I've accidentally written out. So I did a trilogy, did 3 different shows. One which was me chatting. Then there was Sherlock Holmes monologue and another monologue. And then there was Buckethead, the first Buckethead, which was with Jeff Green as the interrogator, and me and Andrew Bailey backstage swapping costumes, wearing buckets. Lots of different bucket characters being interrogated, and a sort of revolution at the end. Only ever worked once. So I had an impossible video cue. The play had to end at the moment the revolution happened, but of course it never did. So I had to sort of sneak on and press forward wind to the moment on the videotape where the revolution happened. But it worked once properly, but anyway. So then Sherlock Holmes, and did that for radio, and then...
So what's the premise of the Sherlock Holmes then? The
premise is that he's... All Sherlock Holmes stories are written from the perspective of Dr. Watson. This is written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, who is sort of accidentally falls into being a detective. He's got an agent. It's a bit like a comedian. He's got an agent who's the real power behind him. Who is Watson? He's his agent, manager, case arranger, who has lots of other detectives as well that he works with. He's a sort of front man. He's got something about him that is quite convincing when he... They know nothing, really. It's a question of pointing your finger at someone and making the evidence stick, and how they came up with when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains however improbable must be the truth. It sounds scientific, but it's nonsense. It's impossible to eliminate the impossible. That's it. There are infinite possibilities. You know. Once you've abstractly narrowed down the possibilities to a finite number,
there's still more.
yes, you're wasting your time. There are only, basically, comes to, the Sherlock Holmes technique comes down, there are six people in this room, one of you must have done it. But if you take out that,
using bluff and rhetoric, and a sort of growing sense of guilt. So that was one chapter. And there's a case at the end which he solves by just being overconfident, and the bloke denies it. But it doesn't really matter. It's all finished. They shoot him, so as not to. There's no morality. It's just whether it worked or not. And then the second one, about another one, which is the for 15-minute radio monologue for Radio 4, which is called The Inevitable Invention of Moriarty. He's got a tough. He tries to solve a case on his own without Watson, but it all goes terribly wrong. He doesn't manage to solve anything, and then he realises that if he had an arch enemy who committed the crimes, then it'd be much easier to solve them if he did the crimes himself. So he invents his arch enemy, which is himself, but it doesn't put it to use, but that's the invention of it. And the third one was meant to be for Radio, it was commissioned by Radio 4, but then they, after a year, spent piddling around with it. It turned out they'd already got a Sherlock Holmes pastiche on the boil, so they didn't want it. So I did it in Edinburgh, as a, but that's a three-handed piece, but I did it by changing hats. So I introduced the character Mrs. Hudson, the housekeeper. So we've got Dr. Watson, and it's mainly about them, what they do between cases, how they practice, just games they play with each other, that sort of thing, and some jokes.
And come up with a rhetoric that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, they practice Watson being in a pile of books, which they never read, but they just read the title, and as long as they know they've got the only copy, they can speak with authority of its contents without fear of contradiction. And that, in a nutshell, is the essence of detective's craft, speaking without fear of contradiction. So we say, well, try this one. Soil Types of Norfolk by Professor Lawrence A. Smith. Right, it is you, sir, that committed the crime. But why? Why? Because of the dust, sir, that is clearly on your elbow. It looks like, smells like, and yes, tastes like type 3A sandy loam, a rare soil type found only in the northwestern suburbs of King's Lynn. Well, I've never been to King's Lynn. Indeed not. But the victim had, and it was his practice to go and wallow there in the mud with the others at weekends. And you, sir, clearly murdered him using your elbow. But that's preposterous. Who ever heard of a murder being committed with an elbow? Why, Scotland Yard, for a start. Who can forget the famous elbow murders of 1834, when Lord Hawthorne ran amok and impaled three of his scullery maids with the bendy section of his arm? And in fact, sir, they practice talking confidently in an accusatory way.
It's one of the things that, the most extreme example, because it's a game I play when I get stuck with people that I like that. So at a dinner party, this guy claimed to be the expert on some medieval something, and he was just boring us all to death with it. And I suddenly, which I've done before, but this was most successful, invented an author and a book and a theory on medieval lore, I think it was, that he'd never heard of. And this guy had never come across someone who could invent evidence before. And so I was inventing this evidence, and this guy was absolutely crushed. And the host of the party said, weeks afterwards, he was ringing up and said, please, can you give me Sabrina's number? I want to trace this book. I can't find it anywhere. I've been around the British Library. And it was just...
You never let him know that you...
No, and if you... Yeah, oh, I was bored. And it's...
That's Hitler's excuse for invading the Sudetenland.
I know, it's terrible. It completely crushes someone's whole sort of philosophical theory. But, it is incredible if you do say something with enough confidence. I know a modicum amount about medieval history, but nothing about medieval law, really, or anything like that. And it's great fun.
Yes, lying.
Especially if they're not in the joke. It's called being a con artist. And this guy, I can't remember what it was, but I developed this whole feminist theory, and I was like the egalitarian of the legal system for women, and I'd invented this book and the writer and everything like that. And I was like, I don't. And it was started off with, but have you read so-and-so's argument in? And then rattled it off. And it started, my brother and I played it quite a lot in an early gestation where we'd play this game with completely...
Did you really? Or are you making this up now?
It could be, exactly. One of the games, we had this dreadful woman who used to give us a lift to school, and we just didn't like her at all. And we were both doing our exams, I think. I can't remember what point it was, but we were all struggling because both of us were hopeless. And she was doing her A-level English literature, and she was just driving us crazy, how simple it was and how anybody could do it. and we cornered her once, and we developed this game where you had to get the person talking about a specific subject for as long as possible without them realising it. And we got her, I think it was 56 minutes, on the subject of her A-level. Not A-levels in general, and literature, her A-level literature. And we got her for 56 minutes, and she never worked out, nearly an hour, just saying, so you're finding your A-level really easy, are you? And then she would start straying off the path, and we'd get her back onto it again.
Like and that's how it,
absolutely, absolutely, back into the pen, back into
practice
the pen.
Practice controlling conversations.
But the sheep mustn't know you're doing it.
Yes, oh, indeed. All so, that they're sheep.
She so
they
was.
They might glimpse that.
And we found a model, and we got. She talked about how she'd made her own earrings, and we got. We decided the earrings weren't enough. It had to be one earring, so it had to be the earring on the left ear, and we got that one going for. Oh, that was not quite as long. It was about 43 minutes, but she was really dumb. She was a model, and she got her talk. But it evolved then, and it became like how to sabotage people who we just thought were pompous and arrogant by just inventing a theory.
Facts, yeah.
And it's really good fun. But and I have done it sometimes on stage if some member of the audience has tried to out-clever me. I've always come up with a ridiculous argument or a ridiculous piece of evidence which doesn't actually exist except for in my own head. And it's a great game to play, but unfortunately I'm the only one laughing because the rest of the audience obviously...
Oh, she knows more than us.
They either buy into it and realise it's ludicrous, which is very rare, or occasionally they sort of look perplexed and sort of like they're on their own different tangents. So they can't come in on the game.
Yes.
But I've always thought Sherlock Holmes was right for that sort of treatment.
Yes.
Just throw in and go, oh, for goodness sake, there's more than six people in the room. Have you looked behind the curtains, you idiot? Yes. Or whatever. Take it on to another level. So are you going to... What's going to happen to Sherlock Holmes?
I don't know. I'll write some more, I suppose. That's it. I don't know. Eventually I have a book. So I've got about 15,000 words. Three chapters.
And have you written any books?
No, I only made one book that's on sale, the How to Live, published by the unknown Fiji artist Banksy, picturesonwalls.com. Copy's still available, second edition, absolutely right. That's just a series of like jokes, 19 years worth of jokes, 20 minutes to read. But yeah, it's not much to show, is it? But anyway, it's all right. They sell like hotcakes, so I always take 7 with me to a gig. I feel that's a good number. Just went.
23 is a good number. You could sell 23. It's my favourite number.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I'd rather sell them all and sell out rather than carry some home.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, that makes
psychologically
sense.
Psychologically, it's nice to, you know, basically pay your rail fare.
Yeah. It's always best to have a gig with room for 20 people and sell out than have 200 and have 199 people in it.
Yeah.
On that premise, it works on it. And what about things like telly?
Things like it?
Well, I know you've done one telly with, was it Urban League Against Tedium?
Yeah.
Did you do that on top of a bus?
It was a transit van, yeah.
Yeah, how did that happen?
I did a series for UK Play, which no longer exists, called Footatov, and then another one called Either Or, which is a game show. The first unpleasant game show, which I think, I don't know historically how it happened, but anyway, sort of with an unpleasant
outcome.
And outcome, which abused the contestants. And then the third one, which was for UK Play and BBC Two, which was Attention Scum, which is a sort of low budget thing, but filmed nicely to look like it was expensive. That was that. That was the end.
So did they come to you and say, will you come up with an idea, or did they say, we want to take one of the characters and do something with it?
Can't remember quite. Richard Webb, the producer, had done the first two. I met him in Edinburgh and he said, do you want to do something for UK Play? So I said yes and made a thing. Because the League incident was sort of TV, I was making TV anyway, like little films and using cameras and things. I should do some more of that. Put it on the internet, if I could be bothered. That's what I should do. You know, it's all, you know, wide open pasture out there.
Yeah, yeah.
I've made some little films. That's another thing I made. Which is on show at the... what's it called? Santa's Ghetto, the Banksy and Co. underground street art shop on Oxford Street in December. In the back room they had a little cinema. I had my film on loop. and made a 10-minute film called One Down, about the two thieves that were left on the crosses after Jesus was taken down. So that, and the crowd's gone. It's just these two cardboard animated. I moved their mouths and eyes. That's all that moves. And they chat to each other about stuff before dying. It's quite bleak, but darkly funny, I suppose. But about 9 minutes. 9-minute film. It's all right, isn't it? I've made lots of films. What else I did? Made one for the Tate Modern last year. For Pierre Huyghe. The Frenchman.
I don't know. Never heard of him.
He got some comedians in to do a gig. For the second gig, you were meant to have done something influenced by him. I was going to be in LA as Banksy's official spokesperson, which is fun. So I made a film for them to show. So I think the last I heard, they're going to put on the Tate website. So, yeah, I've got a film on the Tate website. I'm an artist.
Oh, that's it. You see, you're comedy interfacing with modern art.
Yes.
So how did
between
you get
stools?
So how did that happen? Did they sort of know about your films? Or did they come and see your show and say, "Hey, you know what we really need is you in the Tate Modern"?
No. I came through Robin Ince. Got me the gig. I don't know how I got the gig, other than Robin Ince said, "Do you want to do this gig for the Tate Modern?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So I did the first one, but I knew it wasn't going to be able to be there for the second one. They only told me the date late on, and I would have already got this ticket to LA. So I thought, well, I don't have to be there. That's one of the things I took from Pierre Huyghe, his art. He's got a lot of films and things. You don't actually have to be there to do your art. You can make a film. So I made a little film. And then I made another one for the Battersea Arts Centre. They did a thing about the Great Fire of London, so I made a little film for them. And another one for Mel Brimfield. I don't know what her grouping was called, but like recreations of performance art. He did, and they actually asked me to do a recreation of Andy Kaufman's wrestling women thing. So at Bethnal Green Working Men's Club, I wrestled four women. But before that, they showed a video I made to wind up women to get them angry enough to wrestle me.
Or was it like a proper wrestling ring?
It wasn't a ring. It was, they had mats down and a referee and a space, and it was.
And the audience came in, and then you.
No, they were there anyway, watching other things going on. There's lots of different performance art things being recreated.
Oh, okay.
At the end, it was now.
And then they screened your. They screened my wind up.
Yes, which did. I did wind them up.
And then you went on and said, "Is there anyone prepared just like Andy?"
Well, I had three prepared women who were prepared to wrestle, but it was still full real. Like they'd be going, "No, I'm going to beat you." Joe Carr was pretty keen to was going to do me, but I put her down easy. but the thing was, I hadn't really bargained on the fact that, okay, so I had four bouts, like 3 minutes each. It's very tiring, full on fighting. Between, because after each one, I was getting more tired, and the next woman would come in fresh. So by the third woman, I was, and I'd had food poisoning the night before, so I hadn't eaten anything. A bit weak. Anyway, collapsed on the last one, and then came back to win the final one. So 3-1.
Yeah, I consider that winning. Yeah,
I consider it winning.
Yeah, consider that winning.
I don't fear women. When I'm in the wrestling ring.
On end.
Generally, of course, in life, God.
And did you see what Andy Kaufman got out of it?
Well, he got out of it.
Yeah. Did you like? So now I could really understand why he got into it, because I can't understand what he got into.
That's a hilarious thing to do. Why? Proclaim yourself intergender wrestling. I think it's funny, intergender, and you'd only wrestle women. Have you seen the video of it where he goes, there's a long, story of how he comes.
No, I've read the book and I've seen the movie of Jim Carrey's movie, but I haven't
actually.
Actual
footage of him.
No, I've never seen it.
Him wrestling women is hilarious, isn't it? But it's also, he ends up wrestling this bloke as a trainer of one of the women who gets in the ring and sort of damages his neck. And then they have a grudge match for ages, and it turns out then they do a tag match with two. He gets a partner, and he gets the other bloke's partner to betray him. So then they have finally it ends up with him and the man he hates, and the man who hates him fighting together against these two partners who have betrayed them. And then, but actually, it's all a con because Andy Kaufman had paid the other two, and they all gang up and beat up this bloke. Long-winded story.
And it went on for like 3 or 4 years or something, didn't it? This grudge, gradually he worked it around that the guy became his partner,
How true it is, but it was well done, anyway. So, hats off to Andy Kaufman.
No, because he just did it for such a long time, and I just thought, well, I can imagine doing it once or twice, but he obviously got a lot more out of it, because it was just like.
I mean, it was And the crowd hated him. It was hilarious to hear the... although, by the way, there was something very funny about whole crowds hating someone to watch. I mean, Ted Chippington, who's benefiting on coming up next Tuesday. His record, Man in the Suitcase, I remember crying with laughter listening to that. There's a bit of it when he goes, oh, you have to bleep this. There's him dying at a gig. The crowd are going, who the fuck? Who the fuck? Who the fucking hell are you? Ted Chippington. Who the fucking hell are you? Ted Chippington for the third time. Let's see you back supporting me with get yourselves a group together, lads. Couple more numbers. At the time you're there, you think, oh, that looks awful. You go, but listening back to it, very funny.
And so, do you think you'll repeat that exercise? Could you do an Andy Kaufman?
No, done it. It was a one-off thing, but yeah. Just reminded me that I have made some films in the last year.
Yeah, you've done an awful lot. I don't. I think yeah, you forget what you've done.
Which was what you're doing now. I made a painting recently. Should be thinking about the next thing. Right, I've got things I should be writing that I haven't done. I'm a columnist. NewStatesman.com. Every 2 weeks. The website, New Statesman website.
And what's your brief on that?
Ending like.
Really?
So far it's been school, pool, Yule. And the next three are going to be, one's out, cars, bras, stars. See, I give myself a framework, which is groups of three words that rhyme.
It's great, because it's amazing how creativity can come out of a really confined space. If you really narrow it down.
You can write anything, means you write nothing.
You haven't got a car, do you actually drive?
I have been spent a lot of time recently in cars.
Right.
Each column begins, recently I have been, just give it that topical feel. So recently I've been looking at schools, recently I've been playing pool, recently I've underwent Yule. But I ran out of things that rhymed with all. Wool, I thought it was a stretch, but
if you could get to some really archaic African implements or something, yeah, that might rhyme with
it. Tool, careful.
I think there's something called the Yule or something.
There is
a
Yule, is it?
I think there's an instrument, yeah. But again, you see, I could be making that up. Sometimes I forget what I've made up and what is true.
Yes, I should
bear that mind
with you.
The same problem?
I had a girlfriend once who used to hold it against people what she dreamt about them. What?
That's brilliant.
Nightmarish.
Was she good in relationships? Or did she go through them quite quickly?
She's still having trouble.
Depending on her dream sequence.
Yeah. To willingly conflate what you dream. No line. Yes.
Because you're also doing a very important radio show on Monday. So
Resonance.
You've got huge audiences, apparently.
Seven, eight.
Yeah, at least.
Resonance FM, noon till one. Keep planning to do things for that and not really quite getting around to it.
What's the brief on that?
Just chat a bit, play some records.
Right.
Have guests in.
You don't come up with a rhyming theme each week?
No, should do. Oh, we've come up with this week. Last week was Spain and death. And this week's is going to be secrets and revelations. I thought I'd try and write some sort of sitcom set in the outback.
Has a religious flavour to it or not? Or maybe a reference?
I'll read out a bit from Revelations and see if that needs mocking. Or if any of it's come true. I get Jehovah's Witnesses delivered. They come to the door. One came the other day and read out the bit from Revelations which says about people living forever and in peace. Would you like that? And it was like trying to sell me. I thought for a moment. No, I've had. I used to have them into the house, last house to live, and it's very nice. You know, a man named Stephen, and he'd sit there and read the Bible with you, and I really enjoyed it. But I didn't want to go through that again. And I said, no, I don't want eternal. There's an obvious flaw with it, an eternal wheel. Will we have children still? Will it just get overcrowded? Some magic. We don't have children, in which case part of the joy of life is lost. And it must. The threat of death gives things its poignancy and excitement, surely.
And what did he say to that?
No, I didn't say
that.
I thought, look, no, but I don't want to start this conversation because I know it doesn't end.
It sticks,
You'll have something prepared from a book.
I didn't want to waste their time. You're not.
Well, they themselves are a very strong argument against eternal life, aren't they? Because once you start up that relationship with them, they will go on. And if you live for 300-400 years, you'd know that once a week you'd have to have this almost Groundhog Day conversation, because they're not going to change. So they are an argument to me against eternal life.
Yes, if they're right, they're wrong.
Exactly.
They wouldn't want to live in a... But, you know, they seem like nice people.
Oh, right? I'm sure they're charming.
Yeah.
They don't mean any harm. It's just the repetitiveness.
They've never asked for money either. I'm quite impressed by that. I mean, obviously, at some point, you've got to... There's money you've got to go into it to pay for their buildings and their printing, all those watchtowers.
It's people who do want those eternal life. I think they put their money in. But if you don't want eternal life, I think, yeah.
If you don't want eternal life, it's free.
It's free, exactly. That's the cop-out clause. Because, again, another thing that strikes me is that there's not a particularly... what I would call a moral code to what you do. You just don't... You don't particularly mind which side of the fence you're arguing or you're putting your point across with.
No,
would that be true, no?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe that's how it works. That's how it is. Moral code.
You know, there's some... put it like this. There's some comics who put a very strong moral element in what they're doing. That has a very... Well, Mark Steele and Mark Thomas, and they have a very particular slant on which direction they're going. Whereas, would you say that's true of you?
I like the Marshall McLuhan phrase, the truth, brackets, and this should be said in an Hercule Poirot accent, the truth is whatever upsets the apple cart. I think that is a Hercule Poirot accent, but yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, eternal life. Sisyphus, of course, the story of Sisyphus, the myth of Sisyphus.
I can't remember, tell me.
Sisyphus cheated death, and the gods punished him by giving him eternal life. Forced to push a rock up a hill, only to watch it roll down the other side over and over again forever and ever. So, eternal life being looked at as a punishment. I should have mentioned that to the witnesses.
Well, there's a new thing coming out about old age that we might... That old age, you can actually stop age, but so you can stop the aging process, but people will die because they will just die. They just
have enough.
They've found that some people the aging process stops at maybe the late 60s, and they can live to maybe like this woman in France who died at 123, and they think she might be an example of someone where the aging process actually stopped.
Yeah.
And she managed to continue living.
Reach equilibrium. Yeah.
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 Absolutely, but then she just died because everything just became frail, not because it aged anymore. Which again is another whole... Well, it sets my mind off in a whole another series of directions. It's like, oh, that's kind of interesting.
Well, you can just carry
and then you
on.
Get these kids who start aging from the age of 6 months, and they're actually got the bodies of sort of 80-year-olds by the time they're 12 or 10.
And
you can have the inverse of that. Yeah.
Yeah. There are certain people who will not... The immortals.
Yeah.
Dum, dum, dum.
I don't want to meet one.
No.
I think it'd be very, very scary. I quite like to talk to that French lady. She sounded a bit batty.
I'm 23. Seen a few changes.
Yeah. Have you seen any change in the last 125 years?
Yes. Have you seen any change? Well, what's it all about?
I used to have a ringer.
What have you learnt?
So you've got Resonance going, you've got the New Statesman going, you've got gigs going. And you're loving, I think last time I spoke to you, you said you were really into literary festivals, or you...
Port Elliot Literary Festival, but yeah, I'm particularly into that one, doing that again this year. Glastonbury, hopefully. Edinburgh. The English season. Port Elliot, Glastonbury, Port Elliot, Edinburgh, rest.
So what is it about book festivals that... You like then?
That's just the one. Port Elliot.
I thought you did the Hay on Wye, didn't you?
I think I've been to Hay on Wye with Hegley once. It was all right, but I like the Port Elliot because it's small and beautiful, and there's literary things there. There's also music, and it's just a good atmosphere.
So, is there a type of audience that you like or don't like, or doesn't, or do you like just like the change?
No, there's no type of audience. This is... An audience is a random assembly of people.
There's the sort of late night, 12 o'clock, midnight comedy club audience, and then there's
there'll be
5 o'clock in
things.
The afternoon book reading audience.
Yeah, I like a 5 o'clock in the afternoon book reading audience. I quite like a late night
Well, that's, yeah, that's all.
I like them all.
Yeah.
An audience. That's all I can go.
Yes. That'll work for me.
Freeze a crowd. Freeze an audience.
A stool starts to drive you mad after a while.
What does?
A stool or a chair.
Yeah.
An empty chair. Yeah, it just drives you mad. Yeah, because I like ringing the changes. You know, sort of...
Variety.
Variety. So what's going to happen next, Simon? In your unplanned existence?
I'm going to collect my eldest from nursery school. Okay. Helena.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I think we'll end on that.
And make dinner.
And make Thank dinner. You. Exactly. Oh, that's
and then food, that's all. Get some food. Hey? It doesn't, just no good. Too much telly, Gracie. We turn it